Hi, this is Steve Nerlich.
Why? Why cheap astronomy?
Yeah, why?
And this is Dear Cheap Astronomy, episode 143, Not Quite Getting Off the Ground. Some ideas are intriguing and well worth pursuing, but they don't always deliver a result. For example, one of the greatest minds of our time never quite got this idea off the ground. Dear Cheap Astronomy, since mass attracts mass due to space-time curvature, do charged particles attract each other in a similar way? According to Einstein, gravity is the result of curved space-time. You don't accelerate in a gravity field because some mysterious force is dragging you downwards. You accelerate because clocks progressively slow and lengths progressively contract as you move closer to a massive object. In theory, the four forces, the strong, the weak, electromagnetism, and gravity, all involve attraction across a distance and all are mediated by particles. Some observable, like the gluon, and some that are hypothetical, like the graviton. In theory, the four forces can also be thought of as fields. For example, a gravity field or a magnetic field. Although an electromagnetic field is the more technically correct term. James Clerk Maxwell demonstrated mathematically and also experimentally that electric and magnetic fields should be considered two manifestations of the same thing, that is, an electromagnetic field. In his later career, Einstein had high hopes of achieving a similar outcome for the electromagnetic and gravitational fields, which he thought might represent two manifestations of some higher order physics. But the person who had successfully unified space and time into space-time had no such luck with gravity and electromagnetism. But anyway, what is electromagnetism? How does it work? And does it work at all like gravity does? The physics of magnetic attraction is easy to observe, but difficult to explain. Magnetizable metals, like iron, nickel, and cobalt, have the spins of their outermost paired valence electrons aligned. This configuration explains why these metals are attracted to magnets, as well as being magnetizable themselves. Most other things in the universe that have an electromagnetic field first had their elements ionized, and then had all the freed electrons spun around in a coordinated way. Think of the Sun, Jupiter, or even just a small coiled electromagnet here on Earth. However, while spinning electrons are the source of electromagnetism, mediating the electromagnetic force is the job of a boson. And the boson involved in the electromagnetic force is, of course, the photon. After all, light is electromagnetic radiation. So when a charge attracts an opposite charge, or when it repels a like charge, this is shown in a Feynman diagram as an exchange of virtual photons. Such Feynman diagrams are a useful way of describing and predicting electromagnetic interactions, and real photons have been shown to transfer spin, at least in the quantum mechanical sense of the word spin. Nonetheless, an exchange of virtual photons that conveniently appear when required and then disappear again sounds more like a mathematical model than genuine reality. But seeking a deeper meaning from field interactions doesn't help much either. A charged particle can bend the electromagnetic field in a similar way to how mass bends space-time, and that bending of the electromagnetic field can alter the trajectory of another charged particle. But this doesn't easily explain why opposite charges attract and like charges repel. Quantum field theory has, an answer, even though it's not a very satisfying answer. Masses are universally attractive because gravitons have spin too, while charges differentially attract or repel because their electromagnetic force carriers, photons, have spin 1. If that helps you, well, great. So, at the end of the day, it is quite difficult to explain why electromagnetism works, even though it clearly does work. For this reason, it's difficult to say whether there is any common mechanism underlying the operation of electromagnetism and gravity. For the moment, the best way to explain electromagnetism is with quantum physics and virtual photons. At the same time, it's relatively easy explaining how gravity works without ever needing to worry about hypothetical gravitons.
This is the middle bit.
There is a view that Einstein frittered away most of his later career chasing the unified field theory, but that is the life of a theoretician. You run with something until you either get a result, disprove it, or you retire. Next up, here's an idea that really could have got off the ground if it had ever got off the ground. Dear Cheap Astronomy, how realistic was Project Orion? The idea of a spacecraft propelled forward by dropping nuclear bombs out the back was first proposed back in the mid-1940s, then floated again by researchers at Los Alamos in 1955, and then funded as a development project, that is, Project Orion, from 1958 until 1964, when it was finally canned after the US government signed up to a global treaty banning nuclear explosions in space. Currently, our spacecraft either have high thrust, like the Saturn V, which burned through 3 million metric tons of fuel to achieve orbit, or otherwise our spacecraft have high propellant efficiency, also known as specific impulse. A good example being an ion drive spacecraft that can fly between planets on half a metric ton of propellant, although they do that very slowly. However, a nuclear pulse drive has both high thrust and high propellant efficiency. Since you expend a relatively small amount of mass in the form of a nuclear pulse unit, which is what most of us would call a bomb, and then gain a huge amount of thrust from its subsequent explosion. A spacecraft with a nuclear pulse propulsion drive was envisioned to be rocket-shaped, and at its base was a pusher plate, essentially a large flat disc which would take the full force of the nuclear blast, gaining momentum from it, as well as protecting the rest of the spacecraft from it. Between the pusher plate and the rest of the spacecraft were shock absorbers, so that rather than experiencing hard jolts each time a nuclear pulse unit exploded, the crew would experience a fairly linear acceleration arising from the cumulative effect of each of the blasts. Any thrust that can be gained by a nuclear explosion in the vacuum of space is all about debris velocity, since it's only in an atmosphere that you'll get a shock wave from an explosion. So a lot of thought went into the design of the nuclear pulse units that were dropped out the back of the spacecraft. These were cylindrical, with internal geometries including radiation mirrors, that directed most of the explosive blast in one direction, that is, back towards the spacecraft. At the blast end of the cylindrical pulse unit was a thick layer of tungsten, which is technically the actual propellant. So when the bomb explodes out through the tungsten would disintegrate into fine particles, and those particles would be driven at huge velocities back towards the spacecraft's pusher plate. Tungsten was presumably chosen as it has the highest melting and boiling point of any element, and so would be most likely to remain in solid particulate form in the face of a nuclear explosion. The Project Orion planners enthusiastically promoted the idea that you could build a nuclear pulse spacecraft with the technologies and materials available in the 1950s and 1960s. After all, they did have nuclear bombs, and building the rest of the spacecraft just required conventional materials. A prototype design envisioned a moderate-sized spacecraft driven by pulse units the size of soft drink cans. And allegedly, the designers consulted with the Coca-Cola company about adapting the internal mechanism of soft drink vending machines, which could move and subsequently release a series of soft drink can-sized objects. At this time, questions remain about whether the pusher plate could remain intact in the face of repeated nuclear blasts, where there would be no opportunity to replace it over a long-distance space mission to a remote destination. But in any case, the whole design concept just isn't politically palatable, since it requires building large numbers of small nuclear devices, where a deep space mission might need thousands of them, and losing track of just one from a manufacturing plant on Earth might lead to a major terrorist incident. As with many great engineering ideas, it's really people that are the problem.
This is the end bit.
So, there you go. There are some great ideas out there that sound like they really should work, but never quite do. And there's other ideas that probably could work with the right kind of commitment and budget, but no one's game to tackle them because the idea is just too radical for public consumption. But that's it for another episode of Dear Cheap Astronomy. If you've got a space science question, or you just want to tackle something too radical for public consumption, why not write to cheapastro@gmail.com and we'll do the taste testing for you. Thanks for listening. Steve Nalick, Cheap Astronomy.